As we sail deeper into the south, so the belts of green land on each side of the river narrowed. Now the desert began to squeeze in upon us. In places, brooding cliffs of black granite trod the verdant fields underfoot and pressed so close as to overhang the turgid waters of the Nile. The most forbidding of these narrows was known as the Gates of Happy, and the waters were whipped into a wild and willful temper as they boiled through the gap in the high cliffs. We made the passage of the Gates of Happy and came at last to Elephantine, the largest of a great assembly of islands that was strung through the throat of the Nile, where the harsh hills constricted its flow and forced it through the narrows. Elephantine was shaped like a monstrous shark pursuing the shoal of lesser islands up the narrows. On either side of the river, the encroaching deserts were distinct in colour and character. On the west bank, the Saharan dunes were hot orange and savage as the Bedouin, who were the only mortals able to survive amongst them. To the east, the Arabian desert was dun and dirty grey, studded with black hills that danced dreamlike in the heat mirage. These deserts had one thing in common. Both of them were killers of men. What a delightful contrast was Elephantine Island, set like a glistening green jewel in the silver crown of the river. It took its name from the smooth grey granite boulders that clustered along its bank like a herd of the huge pachyderms, and also from the fact that the trade in ivory brought down from the savage land of Kush, beyond the cataract, had for 1,000 years centred upon this place. Pharaoh's palace sprawled over most of the island, and the wag suggested that he had chosen to build it here at the southernmost point in his kingdom to be as far from the Red Pretender in the north as possible. The wide stretch of water that surrounded the island secured it from the attack of an enemy, but the remainder of the city had overflowed to both main banks. After Great Thebes, West and East Elephantine together made up the largest and most populous city in the Upper Kingdom, a worthy rival to Memphis, the seat of the Red Pretender in the Lower Kingdom. As at no other place in the whole of Egypt, Elephantine Island was clad with trees. Their seeds had been brought down by the river on 1,000 annual floods, and they had taken root in the fertile loams that had themselves been transported by the restless waters. On my last visit to Elephantine, when I had come up river to do a survey of the river gauges for my Lord Intef in his capacity as guardian of the waters, I had spent many months on the island. With the assistance of the head gardener, I had catalogued the names and the natural histories of all the plants in the palace gardens, so I was able to point them out to my mistress. There were ficus trees, the like of which had never been seen elsewhere in Egypt. Their fruits grew not upon the branch, but on the main trunk, and their roots twisted and writhed together like mating pythons. There were dragon's blood trees, whose bark, when cut, poured out a bright red sap. There were Kushite sycamores and 100 other varieties that spread a shady green umbrella over the lovely little island. The royal palace was built upon the solid granite that lay below the fertile soil and formed the skeleton of the island. I have often wondered that our kings, the long line of pharaohs of 50 dynasties that stretches back over 1,000 years, have each of them devoted so much of his life and treasure to the building of vast and eternal tombs of granite and marble, while in their lifetimes they have been content to live in palaces with mud walls and thatched roofs. In comparison to the magnificent funerary temple that I was building for Pharaoh Mamosa at Karnak, this palace was a very modest affair, and the dearth of straight lines and symmetry offended the instincts of both the mathematician and the architect in me. I suppose the sprawling jumble of red clay walls and roofs canted at odd angles did have sort of bucolic charm, yet I itched to get out my ruler and plumb line. Once we had gone ashore and found the quarters that had been set aside for us, the true appeal of Elephantine was even more apparent. Naturally, we were lodged in the walled harem, on the northern tip of the island, but the size and the furnishings of our lodgings confirmed our favoured position, not only with the king, but with his chamberlain as well. Aten had made the allocation, and he, like most others, had proved completely defenceless against my mistress's natural charm, and was now one of her most shameless admirers. He placed at our disposal 12 spacious and airy rooms, with our own courtyard and kitchens. A side gate in the main wall led directly down to the riverside and a stone jetty. The very first day I purchased a flat-bottomed skiff, which we could use for fishing and waterfowling. I kept it moored at the jetty. As to the rest of our new home, however comfortable it might have been, Neither my mistress nor I was satisfied, and we immediately set about improving and beautifying it. With the cooperation of my old friend the head gardener, I laid out and planted our own private garden in the courtyard, with a thatched barazza, under which we could sit in the heat of the day, and where I kept my saker falcons tethered on their perches. At the jetty I set up a shadouf, to lift from the river a constant flow of water, that I led through ceramic pipes to our own water garden with lily ponds and fish pools. The overflow from the pools drained away in a narrow gutter. This gutter I directed through the wall of my mistress' chamber, across a screened corner of the room and out the far side, from whence it returned to the main flow of the Nile. I carved a stool of fragrant cedar wood, with a hole through the seat, and placed this over the gutter, so that anything dropped through the bottom of the seat would be borne away by the never-ending flow of water. My mistress was delighted with this innovation, and spent far more time perched upon the stool than was really necessary to accomplish the business for which it was originally intended. The walls of our quarters were bare red clay. We designed a set of frescoes for each of them. I drew the cartoons and transposed them onto the walls, and then my mistress and her maids painted in the designs. The frescoes were scenes from the mythology of the gods, with fanciful landscapes peopled by wonderful animals and birds. Of course I used my Lady Lostris as my model for the figure of Isis. But was it any wonder that the figure of Horus was central to every painting, or that on the insistence of my mistress he was depicted as having red-gold hair, and that he looked amazingly familiar? The frescoes caused a stir throughout the harem, and every one of the royal wives took turns to visit us, to drink sherbet, and to view the paintings. We had set a fashion, and I was prevailed upon to advise the redecoration of most of the private apartments in the harem, at a suitable fee, of course. In the process we made many new friends amongst the royal ladies, and added considerably to our financial estate. Very soon the king heard about the decorations and came in person to examine them. Lostris gave him the grand tour of her chambers. Pharaoh noticed her new water stool, of which my mistress was so proud that when the king asked her to demonstrate it for him, she did so without hesitation, perching upon it and giggling as she sent a tinkling stream into the gutter. She was still so innocent as not to realize the effect that this display had upon her husband. I could tell by his expression that any attempt that I might make to delay him beyond the promised 90 days was likely to be difficult. After the tour, Pharaoh sat under the barazza and drank a cup of wine, while he actually laughed aloud at some of my mistress's sallies. At last he turned to me. "Taita, you must build me a water garden and a barazza just like this, only much bigger, and whilst you were about it, you can make a water stool for me as well." When at last he was ready to leave, he commanded me to walk a little way along with him, ostensibly to discuss the new water garden, but I knew better. No sooner had we left the harem than he was at me. "Last night I dreamed of your mistress," he told me, "and when I awoke I found that my seed had spilled out upon the sheets. That has not happened to me since I was a boy. This little vixen of yours has begun to fill my thoughts both sleeping and waking. I have no doubt that I can make a son with her, and that we should delay no longer. What do you think, doctor? Am I not yet ready for the attempt?" "I counsel you most strongly to observe the 90 days, Majesty. To make the attempt before that would be folly." It was dangerous to label the king's desire as folly, but I was desperate to contain it. It would be most unwise to spoil all our chances of success for so short a period of time. In the end I prevailed, and left him looking glummer than ever. When I returned to the harem, I warned my mistress of the king's intentions, and so thoroughly had I conditioned her to accept the inevitable that she showed no undue distress. She was by this time completely resigned to her role as the king's favourite, while my promise that there would be a term to her captivity here on Elephantine Island made it easier for her to bear. In all fairness, our sojourn on the island could not truly be described as captivity. We Egyptians are the most civilized men on earth. We treat our women well. I have heard of others, the Hurrians and the Cushites and the Libyans, for example, who are most cruel and unnatural towards their wives and daughters. The Libyans make of the harem a true prison, in which the women live their entire lives without sight of a living male, apart from the eunuchs and the children. They say that even male dogs and cats are forbidden to pass through the gates, so great is their possessive frenzy. The Hurrians are even worse. Not only do they confine their women and make them cover their bodies from ankle to wrist, but they force them to go masked as well, even within the confines of the harem. Thus, only a woman's husband ever lays eyes upon her face. The primitive tribes of Cush are the worst of them all. When their women reach the age of puberty, they circumcise them in the most savage manner. They cut away the clitoris and the inner lips of the vagina to remove the seat of sexual pleasure, so that they may never be tempted to stray from their husbands. This may seem so bizarre as to defy belief, but I have seen the results of this brutal surgery with my own eyes. Three of my mistress's slave girls were captured by the slavers only after they were matured and had been subjected to the knife by their own fathers. When I examined the gaping, scar-puckered pits that they had been left with, I was sickened, and my instincts as a healer were deeply offended by this mutilation of that masterpiece of the gods, the human body. It has been my observation that this circumcision does not achieve its object, for it seems to deprive the victim of the most desirable female trait, and leaves her cold and calculating and cruel. She becomes a sexless monster. On the other hand, we Egyptians honour our women and treat them, if not as equals, at least with consideration. No husband may beat his wife without recourse to the magistrate, and he has a legal duty to dress and feed and maintain her in accordance with his own station in society. A wife of the king, or of one of the nobles, is not confined to the harem, but, if suitably escorted by her entourage, may walk abroad in city, street, or countryside. She is not forced to hide her charms, but according to the fashion of the moment and her own whim, she may sit at her husband's dinner table with her face uncovered and her breasts bared, and entertain his male companions with conversation and song. She may hold, in her own right, slaves and land and fortune separately from the estate of her husband, although the children she bears belong to him alone. She may fish and fly hawks, and even practice archery, although such masculine endeavours as wrestling and swordsmanship are forbidden to her. There are, quite rightly, certain activities from which she is barred, such as the practice of law and architecture, but a high-born wife is a person of consequence, possessed of legal rights and dignity. Naturally, it is not the same for the concubine or for the wife of a common man. They have the same rights as the bullock or the donkey. Thus, my mistress and I were free to wander abroad to explore the twin cities on each bank of the Nile and the surrounding countryside. In the streets of Elephantine, my Lady Lostrys was very soon a favourite, and the common people gathered round her to solicit her blessing and her generosity. They applauded her grace and beauty, just as they had done in her native Thebes. I was instructed by her always to carry a large bag of cakes and sweetmeats, from which she stuffed the cheeks of every ragamuffin we encountered, who seemed to her to require nourishing. Wherever we went, we seemed always to be surrounded by a shrieking, dancing flock of children. My mistress always seemed happy to sit in the doorway of a poor shanty with the housewife, or under a tree in the field of a peasant farmer, and listen to their woes and grievances. At the first opportunity, she would take these up with Pharaoh. Often he would smile indulgently and agree to the redress that she suggested. So her reputation as a champion of the common man was born. When she passed through even the saddest, poorest quarters of the city, she left smiles and laughter behind her.